Good morning and welcome to the June 20th, 2022 meeting of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission. This is kind of a special day for us. This is our first meeting coming back after COVID, and so it's just kind of a very special day to be back in session and seeing staff and people and visitors at our meetings, and so welcome everyone here. I'd like to, am I getting some feedback there?
Somebody's trying to.
It's just Commissioner Congdon popping in.
I'd like to thank everyone for participating today and remind you to silence any electronic devices that you may have with you today. For those that who are attending electronically, I would ask you to please mute your device. Today's meeting is a study and business session, and the study session starting this morning at 10 a.m. Excuse me, and the afternoon business session starting at 1 p.m. However, today's agenda, we may be moving into our afternoon topics this morning because we anticipate things moving quickly this morning. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded. If you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand, let us know physically or electronically that you wish to speak. When recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. So let's take kind of a roll call. We have four commissioners present. Is Ann? Ann's, so we have all five commissioners present. Manager Kirk Hudson, General Counsel Eric Wahlquist, and Rebecca Newman, Administrative Assistant. This morning, would you please join Luke Gilbert in leading the Pledge of Allegiance and our safety minute?
Good morning. Thank you. If you would, please stand and join me in paying respect to this great nation as I lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Again, thank you. You may be seated. My name is Lucas Gilbert, and I serve as one of the five chief operators at the Rock Island Hydro Facility, a role I'm currently filling as I bring this message of safety to you remotely from the control room. Today, I'd like to educate and enlighten all of you on one of the key roles of my job, as well as to ask for help from all of you as we discuss two philosophies vital to the future of Chelan PUD, one being the lockout-tagout, and the other being the Human Performance Initiative. A key part of my job is to evaluate risk, from determining impact of removing equipment from service to directing individuals to troubleshoot issues. While doing these evaluations, it often leads us to utilize the lockout-tagout procedure. Like most important procedures, it's more than words on paper. It's a philosophy to minimize, or better yet, eliminate risk. Today, we will look at it in the form of a simple case study. It's one that I think most of us can relate to, a simple act of working on a garbage disposal. Most of us have a garbage disposal, and most of us have had to clear it or retrieve something from out of it. We make sure that it's off, we take a deep breath, reach in, feel around, and clear the problem, but really, how safe is that? The casual approach is often brought with us to work. The machines are larger, the pieces are more elaborate and spread out across facilities that cover acres of land, but much of the work is quite similar. With my brief introduction, I failed to mention that I'm also the father of five kids. Five kids that are prone to making poor choices due to their lack of experience. Any work I do around the home, I have five individuals oblivious to their surroundings, trying to complete conflicting schedules and tasks, and inevitably trying to kill their forefather. In the aforementioned scenario, imagine that I'm up to my elbows in the garbage disposal, and my middle child comes into the kitchen to make lunch. He decides it's a little too dark to make a sandwich and reaches to turn on the overhead light. Now in my home, that is a double light switch right off to the right-hand side of my sink. One of those switches turns the light, the other one is the garbage disposal, and in this scenario, it would be great personal injury to me. Picture his fingers reaching for the switch, probably not looking at it while he or what he's doing, and instead watching a YouTube video on his personal device. Now, let's keep that in mind and apply some of the lockout tagout principles. I could have done any of the following. First, I could have unplugged the disposal from the outlet under the sink. At work, we do one step further by placing a case around that cord with a danger tag. We do this so that some well-meaning individual doesn't see it and inadvertently plug it in, thinking it became unplugged by accident. Another option would be to open the breaker that feeds the power to the disposal. Chances are that would also kill power to other loads in the house, and that is one of the considerations as a chief that I consider when issuing a clearance. Third choice might be to put tape over the switch that I don't want them to operate. Again, at work we have devices that I can put on the switches to prevent them from being operated. With that, we also place a tag on them to identify them as part of the lockout tagout clearance points. Any of these actions, if done correctly, removes most of the risk from the scenario of my son reaching for that switch. That leads me to where we need help, and the second philosophy, which is human performance. If done correctly, any of them would work, but that light switch is just as ambiguous to me as it is to my son. How do I know which of the two switches needs tape on it? Could I make an error and put tape on the wrong lights or on the light switch instead of the disposal? And the answer is yes. And the solution is fairly simple. Labels. Unfortunately, we don't have a standard labeling convention. Many new pieces of equipment are not coming with any labels whatsoever. With that, there are conflicting views on what the labels should look like or what information should be included, depending on the work group. Some prefer labels of the manufacturer, like the devices, or the manufacturer of the devices, like Westinghouse or Sontag. Others prefer something closer to serial numbers, so that if work is needed, they know what parts need to be ordered or which work package to pull. I, as an operator, prefer noun names of what the component is, with unique identifiers as to which unit is associated with. All this leads to the fact that a standard needs to be developed to properly utilize the human performance tools we are currently training on. As mentioned before, another option for isolation was to open the breaker. In most of our homes, our breaker panel doesn't change. The breaker load list stays exactly the same. Here at the PUD, those breaker lists are considered engineering documents, and the loads are being changed quite frequently. New panels are being installed with the modernization of the old units at Rock Island, as well as the new facilities that are being constructed at the site. Isolating power by an operator is only as good as the engineering documents that identify the load being fed by the breaker. Unfortunately, those documents are not being approved. Because of that, they are not being placed in the drafting search system for operators to reference before the equipment is being turned over to us. This forces us to rely on memory and word of mouth when isolating loads, and it removes our initial check for energy isolation for the craft and puts the sole responsibility on the worker in the field. Prints and procedures are the tools operators utilize in the same manner as a voltmeter for the wireman or a pressure gauge and a drain line for a mechanic. Labels, drawings, and procedures are all building blocks of the HPI program, and they're also vital to the lockout-tagout procedure as well. I believe a decision to reinforce those building blocks of the HPI program would do wonders to support other key policies like the lockout, tagout, and safety policies. Thank you for your time and attention. Does anybody have any follow-up questions for me?
Any questions for Luke?
So Luke, this is Randy Smith, and I don't have a question. I just have a comment. I don't know that I can recall a more well set up safety minute with your personal message about the garbage disposal. I will never forget that. That really hit home. So thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Luke. For our audience today, I would just like to point out on our front poster up here, our mission is to enhance the quality of life in Chelan County. And our vision is to provide the best for the most for the longest period of time. But one of our key values, the top first key value, is under safety. And it's really important from the commissioner level all the way through the organization that safety is constantly being addressed. And that we as humans, we call it HPI, Human Performance Initiative, is constantly being addressed, that we're constantly learning from each other. We're constantly checking our own self-learning. We realize we make mistakes, and we make this is a value that we really want to stress and continue to move forward. So, Luke, thank you for your great presentation and your ongoing work. And at this time, I'll turn it over to Kirk for our CPO winner recognition.
Yeah, I'd be delighted if Danny
would do the agenda first.
Oh, I am just racing ahead. I skipped right over number two. So, commissioners, resolution 12 and 17 have been recommended by staff for the consent agenda. Additionally, for the public's information, items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer to the regular agenda upon request of any commission member. Commissioners, do I hear any such request or additions to the agenda? Hearing none, the agenda stands. Okay, now we will go on to CPO winner.
So it's my honor today to recognize Danny Flaggett, administrative assistant in finance. And just for those listening in and those attending, once a month we recognize an employee. We have what's called a cycle of personal ownership recognition award, and we also have an above and beyond recognition award. And the senior management team looks through all the nominations for the cycle of personal ownership and selects the one that most exhibits that cycle of personal ownership, and we vote on them. And Danny was May's winner, and I'd like to just share a few words of why she was recognized for the ownership. We have a district performance plan that we report on at a minimum once a quarter. We report to our Board of Commissioners on the district performance plan. And every business unit in the district actually uses that to identify where they're at on progress on key initiatives and projects. And so we have a process to update that on a quarterly basis, and some people even do it on a monthly basis. But Danny recognized a lot of this flows up through her, and she gets it in final format for the district and the Board of Commissioners, and she recognized that there were some formatting improvements that could be made, both in terms of the display, how we track, whether something's on track, behind, or a concern. And so she reformatted it, and in that process, it's more pleasing to the eyes to look at. And it also was part of a process improvement that she identified, which automates the calculation of how many projects we are concerned about, how many projects are behind, and how many projects are on track. That was a manual calculation each time, and so now if you use the formatting correctly, it automatically calculates that. But just a great example of Danny in her role, seeing things come to her and identifying a way to improve upon it, both reducing the chance of human error and also making something even improved in terms of format. And she did that all on her own and working with others as needed, but recognized it and put the improvement in place. And so we're all benefiting from it. Business units can actually use this as well for their own business unit reporting if they choose. They can take advantage of the improvements that Danny made. So thank you, Danny, for seeing a need and stepping in there and just filling it, and we're better off today because of it.
Thank you for the recognition, and thank Kelly for the nomination. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Any comments from the board?
I guess I have to make a comment because I was in fun before the recording started, was introduced to Danny, and made a smart aleck comment of, yeah, I know you're Danny, but who are you? And I, and her instinctive response, which the rest of the commissioners can't see at this moment in time, was just a brilliant smile that just puts some light on the day. And I'm I'll have to wander back to Kelly's office to say hi once in a while now that we're back in person.
Thanks, Danny. It was interesting. Go ahead, and you're welcome to go back. But it was interesting visiting with Danny earlier that Danny came on just as COVID started. So it's the first time I've met her, and she's been here for a couple of years doing great things, and today's the first day I actually get to meet her.
So yeah.
Special day. Thanks. Thank you for the CPO nomination, Kelly. And Kirk, thank you.
Thanks, Danny.
Kirk, I just have a question. We have so many folks here to talk about Fifth Street redevelopment. Maybe we should switch items 4 and 5. Ron, do you care if we put you off just a few minutes? And
I think that would be appropriate.
And I think that way people aren't waiting and they can get on with their busy lives. So let's go. If everybody's okay with that, I'd like to switch that around. So Dan Frazier.
Thank you, Commissioners. Dan Frazier, get my tie back to my computer there. Dan Frazier, Director of Shared Services. I'm here today to present to you a recommendation on the Fifth Street redevelopment process we've been working through for several years, actually. I would like to recognize some people that are here that helped get us to this point. If I can look around the room, make sure. I got Steve Wilkinson from the Chamber, recent addition. Rufus and Dory from the YMCA, we've talked to them over time. Steve Robinson was part of the group that was on the advisory committee early on. David Lodge, our project manager, has been involved in this project for quite a while. So quite a few folks here that have been part of this process for like I said, a couple of years. So today, let's go. There we go. Today, this is information only, but we are going to make a recommendation. There's no board action requested. So I'm going to go over the process that we've gone through during this request for proposals. We'll talk about the scoring and the selection team recommendation, and then overview of the next steps in the process. So a lot of text on this slide. So this has really been a process. It's not a statutory process, but we've very closely followed what we do in more statutory request for proposal processes. We issued an RFP in March. We held tours and pre-proposal meetings with interested developers. We extended the date at the request of a couple of developers because they just felt they needed a little more time, and they were a little late coming to the realization that this project was out on the street. We held some additional tours. We received and opened 4 proposals on May 16th. And then the selection committee met twice, once on May 20th, once on June 14th, to review and rank the proposals. So that's where got us to today and our recommendation. The selection team, made up of what we've called our core team from the beginning of this project, these 5 entities, PUD and our 4 partners, have been involved from 2018. We signed an interlocal to move forward on this. And Chelan PUD, Chelan Douglas Regional Port, which at the beginning of this was the Chelan County Port Authority, the City of Wenatchee, Wenatchee Downtown Association, and the Wenatchee Valley Chamber of Commerce. And that team has spent countless hours on working through the redevelopment planning process, on putting together the requirements of the RFP, and putting together the criteria around which we eventually ranked these proposals. And now getting along the process of evaluating and recommending what we're recommending today. Before I go to that, I referenced the planning process we went through in 2018 and into 2019 and 2020, and that was a process that involved our customer owner advisory committee. And so we went through a process with a consultant developer. They actually had developers on their team and architectural consultants, and they helped us develop this criteria, this vision for the site. We actually referenced it as the community vision document in the RFP. And that's really what guided all of the discussion around what we're asking for and as we got to evaluation, what we were looking for in a proposal was really guided by what that community advisory group provided for us. So I'll go through the these. I went through at the last meeting what the four were, and I'm going to take these through in their rank order and give a brief review of what was included and then what the team felt the strengths and potential gaps in the proposals were. So proposal number four is Kidder Matthews. If you recall, this had the new YMCA facility, had a multi-residential component, a higher-end hotel. It also redeveloped the current headquarters building and would sell the adjacent Fish and Wildlife building to another individual that have a business in that facility. Their ranking, their score was 78 out of possible 224 points. The strengths of the proposal, it did have a good residential and hotel use, which was some of the uses identified in the proposal, or the visioning document. They had an ability to start quickly, which was something we identified as something we didn't want the site to sit for a long time, so they did have a pretty quick start for the project. They also had a lot of surface parking. We know that's an issue all throughout downtown. The waterfront is inadequate parking, so they did provide a good amount of parking. The concerns the evaluation team had were really around the experience of the developer with like projects. They had done just mostly residential type projects, not much of this commercial redevelopment. Not as much adaptive reuse, which this adaptive reuse is the reuse of an existing building. We wanted to make sure that the developer that would be doing this project had experience in working with existing buildings. It's not like a greenfield when you got to go in and retrofit buildings and reuse them. The plan itself didn't propose a lot of improvements to Wenatchee Avenue frontage, and as we went through this process, we referenced an old document that the city had developed back in the early 2000s called the Wenatchee Downtown Subarea Plan, and what that called for was a kind of a redevelopment of that frontage area so that 5th to 2nd felt a lot like downtown. This really didn't propose that kind of improvement to the frontage. Trying to see that last thing, my lack of improved, I can't read that last word. Is that the, oh, there we go, circulation. Okay, I'm glad I need that prompt. So if you look at this plan, you see the road coming through the middle of the site and then back up to Wenatchee Avenue. One of the things we identified was a connection back to the parking area behind the Wenatchee Convention Center. And some improved circulation was something that was really high on the list of what we were looking for, and this proposal did not provide that. So that's why they ranked on fourth at 78 points. Next proposal is called Sadie B. and Ben Payne. This proposal was for a 46,000 square foot YMCA facility, 40 unit multi-residential. It also redeveloped.
Dan, this is Ann Congdon. Sorry to interrupt. I'm not sure when to jump in.
That's okay.
You're breaking up a little bit. I didn't hear the score that you gave the first group. I couldn't hear. Out of 200, was it? You scored them how?
And we scored them 78 out of 224 possible points.
Okay, perfect. That's what I needed. Thank you.
All right. I'll get a little closer to the mic here for you.
Thanks.
You bet. So the rest of the Sadie B. Ben Payne proposal was to redevelop the current headquarters building, which would include a YMCA early learning component, a restaurant, and some health and education offices. And then they have the current Fish and Wildlife building being used by a local business, North 40 Productions, and sharing parking with the Music Theater of Wenatchee. That proposal had a score of 91 out of 224. The strengths of the proposal, it was a local development team, which was a really nice thing to see. It was consistent with parts of the community visioning document, especially the focus on nonprofit organizations, giving them a place to locate. It had the best accommodation of the Music Theater of Wenatchee's parking needs, and it provided land to the YMCA. The concerns of the evaluation team was that there was very limited experience of the development team in this type of development and redevelopment, especially the scope and scale. Again, minimal improvements to the Wenatchee Avenue frontage, and it was a smaller overall investment in the site. It wasn't as kind of the community vision was to make this something that was a sense of place that people would come to, and it would become an anchor for downtown. So we didn't really see that larger investment that would provide that. Proposal number two is GTS Avara Grambaba Group. They proposed new buildings of a YMCA facility, 100-plus unit multi-residential, 240,000 square feet of new mixed-use office, 3,000 square foot cafe. They also had redevelopment of the current headquarters building as an adaptive reuse for education, and the current tech shop building, and this is a rendering, kind of gives it some scale. The tech shop is the small building underneath that large building to the right of the screen, large kind of a two-component building there. So it's adaptive reuse of a portion, but really a big addition on the tech shop, which was also mixed-use office space. They also show expansion to the south of the site. You can see a plaza down there in front of Music Theater and connectivity back to the south. Here's a site plan of that same development. They scored 145 out of 224 possible. And it was really the strengths were the developer qualifications. This group has done like size and like scale projects before. It was very consistent with the community vision. In fact, if you looked at the renderings there, a lot of the same type of flavor of the community vision document in terms of the massing of the buildings and some of the architectural treatments. They had a good use of green space throughout the site. A lot mix of uses, a little office heavy from what we looked at in the community visioning document, but a good mix overall. And they were looking at LEED certified buildings, which is something we wanted sustainability and energy efficiency to be a priority, and so they referenced LEED certified buildings. If this proposal were to continue in the process, we'd want to talk more about some of the things that the proposal didn't tell us, like how would the parking for Music Theater Wenatchee be addressed. What the arrangement is with the YMCA, there was very little reference to how that would work. The feasibility of a planned underground parking. So most of this site, as you can see, you don't see parking lots because they have quite a bit of underground parking. So is that really feasible in Wenatchee's economic environment? And then explore potentially less density. This was super, super ambitious in terms of what you can fit on a site of this size in Wenatchee. So really just kind of talk through that concern with the developer. But again, 145 out of 224. And our final one was Steinhauer Properties. Steinhauer is proposing an all redeveloped site, complete demolition of all existing buildings and new buildings in their place. So a YMCA facility, 172 unit multi-residential, 211 room upscale hotel, the indoor outdoor dining, some maker space, which is space used for kind of the new tech workshop, so to speak. It's 3D printers and those kind of things. And then they identified an area for a phase two flex office and parking area. So none of their buildings were redeveloped. It was all new. They scored 165 out of 224. And really it was some of the same issues that provided a high score for them was the developer team had worked together for a long time on these type of projects. Their projects that they put in their proposal of similar type were really spoke to the team in terms of what was there, how they would address barriers. The project scale really fits the site. It felt like a pretty natural scale for the site and not overly ambitious, but not ambitious enough. Really good use of green space, good mix of uses. And one of the things that struck the team as very thoughtful that led us to this developer qualification statement was that they anticipated the barriers of a project like this. And that's hard to do when, if you've never done something like this, you can't maybe look in your crystal ball and say, well, we're going to have problems with this and we're going to have problems with that. And so they asked for a pretty substantial public involvement for a public-private partnership to remove some of those barriers. So we thought that was very thoughtful of a developer who's been around the block, so to speak. Some of the things that we would need to know to further consider this proposal is, again, accommodation for his music theater. There was not a lot said about that, although if you look at the site plan, there is quite a bit of parking in the vicinity of music theater. What the arrangement is with the YMCA, this shows actually kind of a larger YMCA facility. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. More detail on this retail dining maker space. They kind of had a note without a lot of development around what that would be and where it would be. And then more information on this request for public funding. So that was some of the things that we would want to go back and talk with this developer more if we go forward. So the selection team looked at all these, pored over these for over a month. We had them in our possession, and And someone asked me the other day, do you need a copy? Or no, they're memorized by now pretty much. We really did scrutinize how the proposals were suggesting that the development would occur. And the selection team had a great discussion over two meetings to come up with this recommendation. So the recommendation was to advance the top two as a short list of proposers to further develop those proposals. So as I mentioned in the last two, there's quite a few things that we need to know more about before we can make a recommendation to the board to enter into an agreement or to start negotiations of an agreement. But we felt those two had the highest potential for success. We are also going to facilitate additional stakeholder engagement to provide feedback. And what the form of that is a meeting with our advisory group, the group that was involved in 2018, 2019, into 2020, and really let them look at these and say, okay, what questions do you have of these proposals based on the work you've already done? How do these speak to that work, and how would we move forward, and what would we ask these proposers to provide? And then we'd hold an in-person workshop or presentation with the selection team and the shortlisted developers to see what they can develop over the next, say, month after we provided that shortlist to them. So that's our recommendation going forward. And how this is going to function, or the plan right now, is to provide this recommendation and then over the next 2 weeks receive public input. We've asked some of the interested parties, if they would like to come to the commission meeting to provide their input, or they can provide it in writing. We will have the advisory group's input. We're meeting this week to solicit their input so we can characterize what the advisory group would like to see. Then we have the July 5th board meeting, and then we would refine those recommendations based on that input. So we'd like to hear from the commission possibly at the July 5th meeting on any input you've received, and help us revise that if we want to change that recommendation in any way, and especially to revise what we're going to ask the shortlisted developers to provide. And then we'd ask for board action on the 18th to formally act on that recommendation at that time. After that, then comes the next phase of work, because it just continues. We would work with the developers to complete that evaluation. We'd move toward final selection, and then we request that the board approve that final selection in September. And we'd spend September, October, and into December negotiating a purchase and sale agreement and a development agreement that would have all the kind of the hammer of this is what is going to be done over the process. And then we'd ask the board to approve those before the end of the year. So that's an ambitious schedule, but I think it's doable. So that's kind of how we've laid out at this point in time. So that's all I had. Any questions or concerns?
Commissioners.
Dennis has his hand up.
Oh, there we go. Dennis.
Yes, Dan. One of the things that would be helpful for me, it's my understanding the property is valued at $6 million. And lacking in the presentation today is the capital contribution by each of these interested parties that related to that $6 million cost. Could you give me those figures if you have them?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'll do it without presenting. So in rank order from 4 to 1, the first proposal was for $4.5 million. The second proposal was for $1.5 million. The third proposal was for $4 million. And the final proposal was for $6
million. What was the last one, please?
For $6 million, the full price.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other hands up? Great.
So, okay. Second question, if I may.
Go ahead, Dennis.
Each one of these plans, and I appreciate it, has consideration for the YMCA and music theater. Is it my understanding that the transfer of property is wholly within the developer and their relationship with the YMCA. And behind that question is the question, is there any commitment being expected from the PUD to contribute to that transfer of property or ownership?
In the proposals as presented, no, that is, there is nothing there requesting the PUD to provide anything for those proposals.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Commissioners, anything else before I open it up to other comments? Dan, we have some guests that would like to speak. You're all good? Great. Well, I would like to take this opportunity on behalf of the commission to thank all of you and your organizations for the great work in working diligently on our behalf to help narrow these options down, ideas to fruition, and come up with a couple of recommendations for us to consider. Really appreciate the hours and hours and hours that have gone in to this work, and would like to commend you for that public service. So thank you. We'll continue to work with you and look forward to narrowing the scope of this down to a couple of options and really asking good questions that will continue to make this a great project. It's exciting.
Thank you, Commission. We appreciate the feedback. And again, if anything you hear that can help us refine our recommendation, we'd love to hear it.
Great. Well, thank you all again.
Yeah, I'd like to just echo the reinforcement of the thanks from the port, the city, and the Downtown Association and the Chamber. This is just absolutely important to our community, and we want this site to be something that's great for our community. So it's just really important to have all of you involved. So thank you.
Great. And we'll let you go. And you didn't even have to sit through an insurance presentation.
Yeah, just before Ron, come on up, and while we're doing that, just we have staff tentatively waiting for determining whether or not we'll get to resolutions in the morning, and just wanted to double check to see if resolutions 12 and 17 were going to be on the consent.
They're on the consent.
Yeah, got it. Thank you.
Welcome, Ron. Thanks for your flexibility and letting me switch that around. So.
No, you're certainly welcome. Not a problem. It's an important project. Oh, okay. My hearing's not working that well either, apparently.
I get told that all the time, Ron.
Before Ron gets started here, just this is our annual renewal, and I just wanted to just introduce that this is kind of it's an interesting process, and in that Ron is working with insurance companies and brokers all the way up until the last minute. And so one of the things you'll hear in Ron's presentation is we kind of settled on some numbers late last week. We're now refining some of those just because that process is continuing and will continue even after today. So with that, I'll let Ron take it away.
Sure. Ron Gibbs, Insurance and Claims Manager. Thanks for the opportunity to present today. As Kirk mentioned, we're looking at the policy renewal for policy year 2022 to 2023. Oops, it's touchy here. So the bulk of the district's insurance policies renewed July 1st. And as Kirk mentioned, we will be negotiating right up to the July 1st deadline. Initially, we had established this $4.8 million figure. the term crystal ball was raised in the last presentation and certainly applies every year as we try to gather together numbers for this presentation. You know, we put out requests to the insurance companies to provide quotes, you know, before our presentation, but they're on their own time schedule. And they typically, many of them will supply their quotes later in the month. And certainly that was the case this year. I think I had probably 25% of the quotes together by the time we had to finalize numbers for the presentation. But we did work with our insurance broker, put our heads together, I should say, and came up with some estimates. We did get a quote late Friday. That causes some concern that maybe these numbers, there's a little bit less margin than we like to have. We usually add a little bit of a buffer in case we get some surprise quotes. And so we decided at that point to see if management was okay with adjusting that $4.8 million to $5 million. And that's reflected on the last slide of the presentation for your consideration as we look for authority to basically purchase all of these insurance policies. So, and then of course, as over time, at some point we'll come back to the board, possibly after the renewal, share the final numbers that we receive. Man, this thing is tight. Page down. Oh, that's good. Okay, page down. Thank you. But before I get too far along, I should have mentioned too that this project supports the district value of stewardship. This work does protecting public resources entrusted to us, managing risk, controlling costs. It's all about risk management, mitigating risks. So the insurance market conditions this year, they've been quite a challenge, but they've been a challenge for the last several years. Certainly over the next couple of slides, I'm going to provide some context, including some of the major factors that are driving the difficult market conditions currently. For liability insurance, obviously wildfire is a top concern, and that was the quote that we received Friday related to the wildfire risk. And, you know, last year we actually had a number of insurance companies that were coming out of the market no longer willing to insure Western Utilities. This year, those markets have stabilized somewhat. We're not seeing insurance companies leaving, but we still have a very small pool of options. Underwriters did share also one of their concerns is the escalating jury awards that are happening nationwide. I saw a lot of trending charts showing how individual claims and litigation results that go through the jury process for whatever reason, whatever social reasons there are out there are increasing. I don't know if Eric has probably seen information on that as well, but that's a big concern for insurance companies, obviously driving up their claims costs. So. They did mention that some of their premium changes were related to that. So again, we do have a reduced supply of insurance related to wildfire risk, and we're also starting to see more and more companies issuing a wildfire surcharge. Last year, Aegis, our primary liability carrier, they supplied the first $35 million of our $150 million limits. They, for the first time, applied a wildfire surcharge that was $125,000 a year just to cover the wildfire risk. This year they upped it to $235,000, and next year they've told us already that we'll be at $350,000, and that is expected to be the final increase for that wildfire surcharge into the foreseeable future. That said, if we have some major fires in the region, I'm imagining they would revisit that. We also received some other surcharges at different layers, but I just wanted to put that out to basically illustrate what the insurance companies, how they're treating that wildfire risk. And there's going to be more in later slides a little bit on some of the wildfire factors. Another major insurance that we purchase is property insurance. And the property insurance companies, they charge a premium based on property value. So for every $1 million of value, they apply a rate to that. So this year, it looks like we're seeing 0 to 5% range rate increases for every $1 million of property values that you have. And these are typically replacement property values if you were to have to reconstruct a property. So last year, it was 5 to 15%, so this is definitely an improvement. But unfortunately, now we're dealing with inflation. And so I'll share some more of those impacts on the next slide as well. But definitely that's going to be a big factor in our premiums this year as the inflation changes. Cyber risk insurance companies have been reporting increasing claims from cyber threats. So they are consequently increasing premiums in the 25 to 50% range to account for that increased claims activity. I just want to say that fortunately we've got a really great partner to help us meet all of these challenges. Last year in May of 2021, we contracted with McGriff Insurance Services following an unexpected departure. We talked a little bit about that last year. Some of you might remember that. And McGriff did an outstanding job coming in and catching up to speed and picking up where our last broker left off, and we were able to renew our program with competitive rates compared to what the market was seeing. So this year we decided to go ahead and enter in an extension of their contract, a two-year extension, no change in the fee. So they're charging us the same as we were charged for the one-year initial agreement. Looking forward to working with them. They specialize in utility business. They only work with power generation utilities. And so their day-to-day job, 40 hours a week, is working with insurance underwriters that focus on the energy sector. And so there's a lot of benefit that you get when you have somebody that's got that level of expertise. In this slide, I'm going to dive in a little deeper into the factors driving the premium increases this year. As I mentioned, property premiums are calculated based on property values. And the way that works is you start off at some point having an appraiser come in and look at what it would and appraise your property values and estimate what it would cost to replace that property. And then over time, you adjust that on an annual basis based on inflation indexes. There's one specific to the hydro generation industry that we use. But from time to time, the insurance companies recognize that, an inflation index is only so accurate, and really you need to have a reappraisal done. So we were requested to supply a new appraisal for Rocky Reach. The last one had been done in 2008. And you can see that the value increased pretty substantially at that appraisal from $2.3 billion that we reported last year up to $3 billion in 2022. And that's a 30% increase. And so the difference in values is partly due to the limitations of using an inflation index, but really another big part of it was the recent inflation that we saw. So recent inflation is also impacting the values at Rock Island Dam and all the assets at the district. And also, as we build new facilities, we add those values into what we insure. That also comes with a cost to insure. So we saw a 16% increase in our property values overall, excluding Rocky Reach. So 16%, which was just inflation and new facilities. And so then if we did include Rocky Reach into that, the property values rose overall 23% from $4.6 billion to $5.7 billion. So, of course, with an insurance company looking at what the range of properties that they're insuring, they're going to apply their rate to those additional values. When we provide the increased premiums in the later slide, you'll see how inflation and the increased value at Rocky Reach are pretty significantly impacting our premiums this year, unfortunately. So on the liability insurance side, I mentioned wildfire risk, and the reason that's such a concern to them first has to do with climate change, and the insurance company risk models that they use show increasing wildfire risk over time for our region as they project temperature increases. Also, the insurance company has had an uptick in wildfire claims activity over the last several years. We can think about the Labor Day fires in Oregon. There were some claims and litigation that's resulted from that. So with the combination between the risk model showing increased risk and the actual claims activity, the coverage for wildfires become increasingly difficult to find at affordable rates, and we're seeing increased pressure on premiums. And I believe that we'd have to see several years of fire-free years going forward in order for some of these premiums to possibly stabilize a little bit more. But we do think that we are going to be able to maintain our current $150 million limit of insurance. Some of our neighboring utilities have really struggled to keep their current levels of insurance, so we feel really good about that. And I think the reason that it's that we think we're going to be able to is we've gotten a lot of positive feedback on the wildfire mitigation work that we're doing, and that's really impacting the insurance company's view of our risk overall.
Can I ask a question about that, Ron, the wildfire mitigation? You probably have two different things that go on there. One is the level of premiums and whether or not you're insurable as we go forward and mitigate. We've had discussion about in some of our heavily forested areas potentially undergrounding more power. How rapidly does that show up as an impact, positive impact on our insurance premiums, or can you even say that?
Oh, I think it's a piece of the overall puzzle that the insurance companies are seeing, because we have a broad range of wildfire mitigations that we're employing, and I was actually going to mention some of this on the next slide. But
okay.
I can jump into it a little bit. When I meet with insurance companies, I'm trying to get the message out about the wildfire mitigation work that we're doing, try to alleviate their concerns, and demonstrate, that we're taking it seriously as an organization and employing all the best practices that we can, essentially, that we can afford to do. So, whether you're talking about the FSOM program, I mean, that's a pretty substantial mitigation effort. A lot of utilities haven't employed these public safety power shutoff type programs. Of course, underground fits into that, our reclosing program that we are employing, where changing sensitivities on the equipment out in the field during peak fire season. All those things are exactly what the insurance companies want to see. And I can tell you that I've had underwriters say, come to the end of the presentation with them, and they've shared with me, well, I don't have any questions because you've kind of touched on all the things that we want to see. So as an organization, I think we're doing a really good job. And, I know that we're partnering with other utilities in our region as well to make sure that we understand what best practices are out there. I've been personally involved with some of that work. So I can say I think that, comparing ourselves to what other utilities are doing, I think we're right in the mix for employing best practices.
Thank you.
Sure. Let's see. We are on slide 6 now, and I did understand we have some newly elected commissioners, and I was asked to kind of give a brief overview of the process. I'll very briefly go through. And I would just offer that if anybody wants to learn more about the insurance process and what goes into that, I'm certainly willing to meet personally with anybody that has that interest. But we start off with seems like a huge number of insurance applications every year with all the different types of insurance that we do. And then underwriters will actually send us questions back, and staff helps provide information and data for those types of questions. This year, for example, we were requested to provide latitude, longitude coordinates for all of our transmission system, which we were able to turn around in a few days. And then that's what they used to apply their risk mapping that they do, the risk modeling, and determine whether or not they feel like we are insurable, to get back to your point earlier. And then we also, work with staff throughout the district to try and develop our marketing presentations. So I go out and meet with as many underwriters as we can to develop as many options as we can. But the goal in these presentations really is to educate underwriters on the quality of our operations and management of our assets, and just to demonstrate that we are properly mitigating our risks. So it's, it's different than personal insurance like homeowners or auto insurance, where, if you have a make and model of a car, the insurance company is going to have a rate for that make and model. The utilities are so much more complex than that. And so that leaves a wider range of outcomes of what underwriters might provide in terms of quotes. And so, as the market conditions change from year to year, you might see upswings and downswings, but there's a range of where those options are. And so we always want to be at the bottom end of that range, as considered one of the best risks. And we are consistently told we are one of the best risks. I was told in my underwriter meeting this year with one of our carriers that the mitigation work that we're doing, for example, on the liability side, he was able to use that to get approval from his executive team to insure Chelan PUD for the first time for us for the first time last year. He told me that we were the only utility in the Western United States that they added as a client because of wildfire risk, and it just comes back to the mitigation work that we're doing. They also, underwriters, speaking of on the liability side, they also really appreciate the risk modeling work and risk analysis work that we've done. We provide our own risk risk mitigation maps, or I'm sorry, risk mapping and modeling as well. And I think overall, you know, they view us in a positive light for the risk that we're dealing with. But at the end of the day, we're also dealing with a risk that they consider quite severe. So it's going to be continued, I think, to be a challenge to ensure our wildfire risk. And all the things that we're doing with our mitigation will help support that. So hopefully we come to a point, you know, where, you know, the insurance companies have seen some history without fire activity, and we might get some relief at some point, but I think it's going to be a number of years out before we can expect that. Most of our property insurance underwriters have actually been working with us for a number of years, so we've had a really good opportunity to educate them on, you know, the professional manner in which we operate our hydro generation assets and maintain those assets. We have engineers come out on an annual basis from the insurance companies, and they look through our maintenance records, speak to our plant personnel. And I think based on all of the information that they've received over the years, they again consider us a top quality risk for power generation. The last report that we got for a mechanical breakdown analysis, they had no recommendations for us. So they really like what we're doing in terms of our maintenance of our dams. We also do fire protection engineering as well. So they also, often I hear how they like how proactive we are. You know, sort of stretching boundaries as you look at our Hydro Research Institute work that we're doing. You look at some of the data analytic capabilities we're starting to build. They really like the fact that we're trying to expand our capabilities going forward, and they hope to see how those efforts will work. I did share with them some of the tools that we've created already, and they were impressed with that. They really like the GE warranty for obvious reasons. You know, insurance companies that removed their risk for the most part at Powerhouse 2 for those new generation units. And then just our investment in generation overall, they really like to see. So, you know, we talked about some pretty substantial changes, but I can tell you, I think, you know, looking at benchmarking what we've done as well, I feel like we're at the bottom end of the rate range as things are moving up and down, whether it's inflation. But things, if we weren't doing all the mitigation work that we're doing, I feel like premiums would be in a much different shape. All right, so I'll just get into some of the premiums. This is the gives you a historical look at the property insurance premiums. You know, I mentioned 23% change in property values. We're estimating a 28.5% increase just based on rate changes as well. So we're thinking a $2.4 million premium is likely this year. And I can say that we've received most of our quotes now for property. And I think that we're going to be very near that number. I think that's going to turn out to be pretty close to estimate. You can see that we have an estimate for the liability premiums. We had in there a pretty substantial increase of 25%. Again, wildfire and then jury awards driving that. So far, we've received quotes for the first $100 million at a 21% increase. The problem is in the top $50 million of coverage right now is where we're seeing that volatility. We got a quote for $25 million of that really we can't live with, dropping back some wildfire coverage. So we may be forced to replace that or try and negotiate with the carrier to change their terms, but that's the uncertainty. And anytime you're switching insurance in and out, at this point in time, it can be costly. So that's why we wanted the additional buffer to get to the $5 million. I guess you can see here that we've estimated $2.1 million. Now, you can see here that, our projection when we finalized our presentation came in at $4.7 million, which is under the $4.8. We still are hopeful that we can come in this range. So we just need some buffer because of the uncertainty is the message, I guess I would say. So you can see the overall premium change, fairly substantial change, 27% increase the way that we have it projected today. Again, we'll continue to negotiate, and, this number could change, and we will come back to the board and update the board if things do change. If our estimate here is correct, we'll be within about half a percentage of the budget. I would say that during the budgeting process, we certainly anticipated the wildfire conditions being a challenge. The inflation and the Rocky Reach valuation, we had really no way to incorporate that into our budgeting process. We didn't know that inflation was going to be as challenging as it has turned out to be. But again, I think we'll be very close to budget. And then if we do receive some outlier insurance quotes, the additional authority we were requesting, I think, will make sure that we can maintain our full coverage, not have any gaps in coverage and have to come back to the board. So I think it'll be an opportunity to just be prudent, I think, to have that buffer. So you can see here the original motion. I believe you've all received a copy of this as well, and the revised motion at the $5 million level. So our next steps, as I said, continue to pursue the best insurance terms and conditions that we can, and then complete the renewals by July 1st with a board update in July. Are there any questions?
Commissioners, are there any questions for Ron? Ron, I'd like to thank you for your ongoing work. This is a big task, and a lot of effort goes into keeping those rates as reasonable as we possibly can, along with all the staff in the district working together to keep the rates, the rate hit, as I would call it, the last, you know, it just seems like it just keeps going and going. But I know everyone's doing their very best, and really interested in those fire surcharges to see if they'll really, this is the last one we're going to give you. I'd like to see that written down. But
yeah.
So commissioners.
Well, I just had a question /comment. I'm not sure. The increase in value of 23%, all driven by inflation? Or plant additions that we've made that increase the value?
So if you were to pull out Rocky Reach, because we did a property valuation for Rocky Reach, and that was a 30% increase.
Mm-hmm.
Pull that out, we had about a 16% increase in value. That part was primarily driven by inflation, and then a small part by the additional facilities, like 1% or 2% had to do with the facilities. But the big driver was the inflation numbers that we received from the index that we applied. So we use a inflationary index called the Handy Whitman Index. So next year, we'll look at Rock Island and have it revalued. It was done more recently, though, 2017, so we're not anticipating as big of a shift, you know, with Rocky Reach being 2008.
How does the rebuild that we're doing at Rock Island impact those numbers?
So
dollar for dollar?
No, what the accountants do is they remove assets that are currently on the books and they replace them with new assets. And, you know, to the extent that those assets are different in price and cost, they can impact it because it looks like, you know, you've added value to your property. But that's where having an appraisal can help, because then they take a more holistic look at all of the numbers and provide their assessment of the overall value. So there can be some differences, though, between what we had on the books versus what we are building and installing.
Right, and I see Kelly's face on here, and I just, for her benefit, say it's amazing how big a difference there is between our book value and our market value.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Ron. Commissioners, do I have a revised motion?
Since I'm in the room, and fellow commissioners, don't get lazy later in the day when we're passing motions, but I'll make the first one today because I'm in the room. I would move to authorize expenditures by the district not to exceed $5 million plus surplus lines, taxes, and fees for the purchase of district insurance for July 1, 2022 to 2023 policies upon terms and conditions approved by the general manager.
Second.
We have a motion and seconded. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
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 Sorry, I was rushing through.
I think motion failed. They know.
Opposed? Signify by saying nay. Motion passes. So thank you, Ron, for your presentation today.
Thanks, Ron.
Dryden Wastewater Treatment.
Got Court Hill today. Ron Slabaugh was going to join him, but is unable to, so Court's going to fly solo today.
So, Court Hill, I'm the project manager for the Dryden Wastewater Improvements Project. And, again, want to excuse Ron, who I spoke with a little bit ago and did not sound well at all. So, so Ron was here and presented to the commission in January, and I'm back here to update the board again on progress, both the project cost and to provide a funding update for the project. We also have a resolution to request authorization to advertise, award, and construct the project, as well as to increase the capital project budget. And then I'll conclude with talking about next steps. So back in January, total project estimate of $3,600,000 to $4,400,000 was presented. Ron also presented some of the funding agreements that were under development at that time. At the very top there, you'll see a commerce grant for just under $1 million. That's administered at the federal level, comes from the federal level, but administered by the commerce at the state level. And then we have the ecology, that's both a grant and a low interest loan. That's administered by the state, Washington Department of Ecology. So the grant was for just under $2.5 million, and the low interest loan for just under $1 million. So the potential external funding, just under $4.5 million. So current cost, today, the capital project is estimated at $5.5 million. The O&M, we did have some pre-cost, O&M costs that are not eligible for the funding, about $37,000. And then the project also requires a pump truck, and this is to take sludge from the Dryden location up to our Peshaston Wastewater Treatment Facility. And that was a decision that was made several years ago when they did an alternative analysis between having a combined treatment facility, and that was shown to be a much more cost-effective alternative. So total project estimate is $5.65 million when you combine all those three items. The proposed capital funding, we've done extensive, staff has conducted a very extensive analysis of the Commerce Grant. We received the funding agreements for that only recently, came well after we had initiated the project. Those requirements are very extensive and not to the benefit of the financial benefit of the district, so we've made a decision not to accept that Commerce Grant.
I would just add that, thanks, Court, I would just add that we think the costs to administer it are very near, if not more than the money we would receive on this. It is a newer process, and the terms are developing as we speak. And so we've done a thorough review, and it is one that we do think it would not be in our best interest. It will also come with other strings attached to it. So at this point in time, we don't think it's worth actually accepting the money, and we have relayed this information back as the terms are being developed, as something that's a big concern for us.
This is federal monies?
federal money administered through the state, U.S. Treasury.
Was this part of last year's infrastructure package?
It's part of the coronavirus state and local fiscal recovery fund.
And you're saying the administration would cost more than the grant itself?
Well, there's a couple things that there's a couple of moving parts with this. One is there's requirements that would flow through to us and increase our costs as well as to the bidders to comply with. And so we would expect both that to be an increase on both fronts. And we'd also expect that there to be additional changes that we'd have to administer to our procurement process beyond this project as a requirement of accepting those funds. So in addition to the additional time it would take to put all these requirements in place will likely delay, come with project delays, will compress the schedule, increase costs that way. So all those things added up in addition to the other requirements and things that would cause us to say, wow, are we really in control of these assets once we put them in place, have us concerned.
You know, the thing that it brings to my mind, and it's an aside, but I think it's important, is if this is the way this looks to us, that package of money that came out to all the states, everybody else is having to look at it the same way, and is that money really of value to the end user? And that's sad.
Yeah. That's one of the significant questions we have, and we are relaying that information back.
Yeah.
Thanks, Court.
Thank you. So we do have some good news, is we still have the ecology grant and the ecology loan. So the grant being $2.5 million and the low interest loan just over $1 million for a total of $3.5 million. In 2020, there was also a public power benefit allocation for $1.5 million. And so the total proposed capital funding is just over $5 million. And I do have a note there at the bottom of the slide that additional low-interest ecology loan may be available. We have met with ecology staff, and they have previously identified that for us. You may recall on our Peshastin water treatment facility, we opened bids. The bids came in above our engineer's estimate. We had to look for additional funding, and so we did request and were successful in getting additional low-interest loan funding for that project. So where do we go from here? Action items. We're planning to finalize design documents and advertise the project here in the next month. We hope to issue a notice of award in September, and then we hope to confirm a construction completion date. We are very concerned about the supply chain issues that have been troubling a lot of our work that we do here at the district, but particularly on a project like this that has a lot of complexity and detail to it. We know for certain that one of our major electrical items, the motor control center, is at least a year out. So we have some scheduling issues, and we have some costs that have gone up dramatically. We hope to issue a notice to proceed for construction in January of 23. And our prime construction window is next year. And to meet the current permit that's been issued by Ecology, we have a completion date by the end of 2023. Mm-hmm. So we plan to begin operating in 2024. Are there any questions?
I have one more question. And I can't because I can't remember. How many customers do we serve with the Dryden facility?
I believe it's 50.
Okay.
We can find out.
Yeah.
Just double check.
Okay.
Commissioners, any other questions?
Well, I just had, oh, go ahead.
I just want to let you know I'm in concurrence with not accepting the one grant that puts all of the restrictions, and some grants are just not worth going for, right, when it becomes so burdensome. So I concur with those, yeah, that decision.
Thank you. I wanted to add, we're certainly out looking for the opportunities, and we'll continue to do so. And right, but there's a whole team that's been working on this. Ingrid Miller, who's here, has been working with legal and external affairs, and just looking at all these opportunities, really trying to understand them in detail to make a recommendation. So I think it's a great recommendation. I would add the resolution, that court does have a resolution this afternoon or maybe even this morning that is tied to the award, advertising award associated with this.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for the update. All right, let's move on to Confluence Parkway.
So I'm going to take this one today. We've got both Justin and Michelle out of the office. Wanted to make sure we're continuing to make progress on this. And so what I wanted to do, most of the effort, if not all of it right now, is focused with the noise consultant. And we're trying to get that work to the point where we can come back at the next board meeting on July 5th with a technical memorandum of what the consultant has reviewed and what they would recommend. And so I was just going to go over a reminder of the timeline that we're working on. We did get the scope to the consultant. They are working on that as we speak. There was a site visit on May 26th, and so they're in the process of looking at all the design assumptions. They're looking at the work that's been done, identifying the gaps, and working with us on what's appropriate to close the gaps in data and information associated with the assumptions into the project design. So making good progress, and we should be back at the next board meeting with the preliminary findings.
Great.
Happy to answer any questions, or if there's other things you want us to be looking at, happy to take those now.
Commissioners, anything on the scope, direction? All right. Thank you for that update.
My pleasure.
So at this time, we will just open up to an opportunity for public comment before we move into some of the items in our afternoon business. Do we have any questions or comments from the public at this time? I see none. Rebecca, you see anything up there? All right. Well, let's go ahead and move into our consent agenda. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us. Do I have a motion to approve the consent agenda?
I would move approval of the consent agenda, which has been modified to add resolutions number 12 and 17.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Dennis. Any discussion? All those in favor of the consent agenda signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Okay, we are now on to resolution number 13.
Resolution 13, oh, I see him online. Okay. We're going to do a little bit. We might have to do a combination of resolutions, and then one, Rob Davis is en route. He may not make it in time, and so we might jump into manager items, but I would like to proceed with this resolution.
So I'll turn it over. You take that however you want to direct.
Thank you. I appreciate that flexibility as we rejuggle things here. So resolution number 13 is a resolution authorizing an amendment to service agreement SA number 17-100 with Universal Protection Service, also doing business as the Allied Universal Security Services to provide district unarmed security services.
Unarmed security service.
Office is Rich Hyatt. Rich?
Hey, good morning, everybody. Hopefully you can hear me.
We can hear you fine.
Well, good morning, Commissioners, Kirk, senior team. Thank you for the time today. I'm here today to get board approval to extend our contract with Allied Universal Services to December 31st, 2025. Allied Universal has been a great partner of ours since 2017. Typically, we have about $1.2 million spent on 50,000 security hours and four vehicles. The proposed contract would seek $4.5 million over the next 3 years to December 31st, 2025, for not to exceed $9.9 million for the whole entire contract. The increase in the hours and pay is due to several reasons. We have anticipated two new positions for the service center. We'll be having a lobby security ambassador, as well as a security officer on the side monitoring deliveries and receiving any and all traffic requests that come through that area. We're also trying to raise our security wages from $15 to $17 an hour and try to get that up to $18 to $21 an hour. We've seen a 10% increase in minimum wage in the last year and a half. We've turned over 21 security officers in the last year and a half. And we think raising their pay to $18 to $21 an hour will help us retain and recruit and keep our security numbers up to par. So with that, happy to take any questions or comments.
Commissioners, any questions for Rich?
Questions for Rich?
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, Rich.
Thanks, Rich. The next one is the one that Rob's en route for, so we'll jump to 15. And this is the one Court just spoke about, the resolution approving bid advertisement award and contract execution for the Dryden Wastewater Treatment Facility improvements. Looks like Court left us. Is he outside?
Yep.
Okay. Court, we're up resolution if you're ready to present the resolution for Dryden.
Court Hill, back here for the resolution for Dryden Wastewater Treatment Facility Improvements. So this resolution is to... for authorization to advertise, for authorization to award, for contract execution, and for the budget increase. The project that we spoke about earlier today, I shared with you that we have a increase in the budget from what we had presented previously, what was in the budget. We're increasing approximately $2.1 million for a total project capital budget of $5.5
million. Okay. Any questions for Court?
I would just add on this one a piece that's a little bit unusual. It's not... is that normally we would advertise and then come back and request the ability to award. This one we're doing both at the same time, requesting the ability to advertise and award from the standpoint of we're looking for ways to streamline the process and the deadline the court and the team are up against in terms of getting the facility improvements done in operation by the end of 2023. This could help shave a couple of weeks off of that process, if not more.
Yeah, the supply chain issues that I spoke about earlier have us concerned. We know that we're very tight. We're going to have a very tight timeline to get material procured and installed by the permit requirement end of 2023.
So, Commissioner, just a note that we've done this before. It's something we've started to use as a tool in the toolbox from time to time where we think there's advantage, but the delegation and the approval to execute the contract and proceed is still dependent upon a fully compliant bid within all the legal parameters required to even authorize. So should anything out of the ordinary happen, we'd be back before you.
Okay.
And I'd also add, too, just, you know, because we've talked about some of these cost increases before on projects, and this is one where, as court showed, the costs are going up, and so this is one that we also looked at is could we defer it with the permit requirement that this be done. We're doing everything we can to try and get this in operation before the permit time frame.
Very good. Thank you.
Thanks, court, for being flexible and taking it today solo.
No problem.
Thanks for filling in.
Yeah. The next resolution we've got Casey Hall online for. It's a resolution ratifying resolution 16 ratifying field work order change order number D-24 and authorizing the general manager to execute field work order change order D-25 to contract 1833 for the Rocky Reach Hydroelectric Support Facility Improvements Project with Leidig Construction of Spokane Valley, Washington. Casey?
Good morning, Commissioners. Casey Hall, Project Manager. So the last time we came to the Commission was on March 21st of this year. At that meeting, the Commission ratified field work order change orders D-19 through 23. Since then, we've issued one field work order change order, D-24, in the amount of $272,607. And district staff has drafted and is recommending approval of field work order change order D-25 in the amount of $718,124. So this will bring the contract with Leidig Construction for the Rocky Reach facilities to a total contract price of $39,503,846. So a majority of the large changes detailed in field work order change order D-24 and 25 are associated with two items. So item one is the CM-17 asbestos roof abatement. So this is the existing shop that we're currently remodeling out here at Central Maintenance. So during the demolition, we found a built-up roofing system underneath the existing metal deck. It contained asbestos materials. So the cost to associated to remove the roofing, install a new vapor barrier, and replace the insulation removed during the abatement process totals $319,449. So project contingencies will cover the cost for this change. There is no budget revision required or requested today. The second item, major item, is reflected in D-25. Totals about $488,302. And this is related to purchases of equipment and shelving for the district that were shown as owner-furnished contractor installed. But we've now shifted that purchase to the contractor, our GCCM contractor, which the contract allows us to do that at a at their set markups in their contract. We've done this to reduce our internal resources. We would have had to have bid these projects and then also manage the contracts. We've now shifted that to the contractor. They're doing the procurement and also the managing those contracts for us. And then ultimately, you'll do the installation for us. Any questions on the resolution?
Casey, I was out there the other day, appreciated the tour, and it's exciting to see the new building in conjunction with the redoing of the old building. I think that's going to be fabulous, a great use of the old building. What was decided for the materials on the roof itself? Is that... I can't remember.
So what type of material we're putting back on the roof?
Right.
So it's a PVC membrane standing with a welded rib in it to make it look like it's a metal roof.
Oh, okay.
But it's a PVC membrane. And then there'll be snow guards on the upper roof and then on the lower roof to stop the ice from falling down onto the ground.
Got it. That was going to be my next question. Thank you for answering.
It's interesting that we try to make a roof look like a metal roof.
Yeah. All right. Any other questions for Casey?
I would just add, Casey's keeping a, you know, as these types of projects where we move with contingency, Casey's keeping a close eye on the contingency levels, and these field work order change orders are within the budget at this particular time, and so he's, and the contingency is being used to absorb those. Just a good reminder of the process.
Great.
And he's getting down to the end here, so.
Well, yep. It looks good. That's great to be out there. Thank you, Casey.
You're
any
welcome.
Any other comments or questions? Okay, I see none.
Okay, resolution 18 is a resolution ratifying field work orders number 1 through 3 and authorizing execution of field work order change order number 4 to contract 21-04 Rock Island Powerhouse to drain piping placement. And we have Tim Scheiman here. This is Tim's first, I think, official board meeting where you're presenting, so welcome.
Rick, thanks. Excited to be here. My name is Tim Scheiman, and I work for the engineering and project management team. So I'm out at Rock Island Dam, and I've got a project that's in execution out in Powerhouse 2 to replace the drain pipes and sanitary pipes throughout 3 levels of the powerhouse. This contract was awarded to Brevo Corporation at the end of last year, and we went through a detailed inspection process in Q1 of this year, and now we're executing the physical replacement of the pipes. The reason I'm here today is because through the change orders that have been issued thus far and one that's pending following this meeting, we are exceeding $500,000 for the total cost of those change orders. And so my request for today would be that you ratify the first 3 change orders and authorize execution of the 4th change order. I'm new to this game, so I appreciate what kind of questions you could be requested of me, so that I can help clarify what's on the table here.
Tim, you might add, just like any of these projects, you might add what we found along the way, just to provide the context for the changes. And
yep, I'll do. Thanks. So we're replacing.
Is that right before lunch?
probably. We could probably all skip lunch. Go ahead, Tim.
So we're replacing cast iron pipes throughout the powerhouse that are 40 plus years old, and they were not installed with sufficient slope to promote adequate drainage of all liquids and pseudo solids. And so we have excess debris that we're finding in the pumps that initially caused some localized corrosion and cracks, which is what led to the problem. But then we found more extensive solidification of materials throughout the pipes. And so that's leading toward the recommendation to today slightly increase the scope of the replacement throughout the powerhouse. We think that as we replace the pipes, we're correcting the deficiencies of proper slopes, that we bring things up to standard building code, so that we've got high confidence that moving forward, we're well over 40-year life of the drain pipes and sanitary pipes throughout Firehouse 2 at Rock Island Dam.
Okay.
Got to ask, this is your first presentation. How long have you been with the district?
Just over a year.
Where from?
I originally grew up here in Wenatchee, and I'm one of those guys that did an internship here 10-plus years ago. So I worked at Rock Island Dam for a couple years, and then I went and worked on forklifts and buses, so Hyster forklifts and Gillig buses, for example, some of the Link Transit buses. We got a young kid, though, now, and so we moved back here, and I'm excited to be a part of the team now.
Now you're sludging around.
But I'm impressed with your engineering training and vocabulary that you navigated the terminology really well and didn't ruin lunchtime for me at all. So.
Might tell him what school you went to. I think that's probably what he was at.
Okay. Undergrad mechanical engineering at the University of Portland, and then grad school mechanical engineering at the University of Washington.
Oh, great. My daughter would be proud of you. She was engineering at UW, so.
All right. Let's see. I'll check with any other commissioners if I have any hands up. I don't see any questions, so thank you very much.
Good job. Thanks, nice Tim.
Work. Come back and see us again sometime.
We are glad to have him here.
That. Give all the cool projects to the new people.
Yeah. George Lynn and I have been friends with his parents for at least 40 years. And it was interesting to watch him grow up in the community and then join the PUD, and they're very proud of him. So
very good.
Mom is an executive at Alcoa for many, many years. Uh-huh.
So, well, it looks like and sounds like
great family.
An example of
benefit.
Sounds like a good example of the benefit of internships.
Hmm. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Resolution number 19 is a resolution declaring official intent under U.S. Treasury regulations of Public Utility District Number 1 of Chelan County, Washington, to pay or reimburse certain expenditures from proceeds of indebtedness and providing for certain other matters related thereto. With us is Heather Ireland, and she also has a motion following this as well.
Yes, thank you, Kirk. This morning I wanted to talk to you about the request for a resolution adoption to potentially have the option to reimburse current expenditures on capital projects in the future with future issued bonds. The reason that this is important for the district is that we have limited tax-exempt bond issuance authority. That means that we're only allowed to issue tax-exempt bonds, which are normally the lowest cost financing option for the district, for certain types of projects. And even though we don't plan to issue bonds today, we have the ability, if we adopt a resolution saying that we want the option in the future, to issue future bonds for current projects. So some great examples of those current projects would be things that are qualified projects for the tax-exempt purposes, such as distribution substations. Those are things that serve the public interest and allow us to deliver electricity to our customers, and therefore they're considered a tax-exempt qualified project. We have a lot of work that we're doing currently on our substation projects today, tomorrow, next week. We know these are ongoing projects, and this provides the board the option to, at a future date, choose to issue bonds and then reimburse ourselves for the funds that we've spent today on those qualified projects. So we can have access to future bond proceeds to pay for projects that are going on currently. If we don't adopt a reimbursement resolution, the tax-exempt authority for the district doesn't go away. It just means we can't go back and reimburse ourselves for qualified projects that are occurring right now. Overall, it creates flexibility for us in the future to have those options to go back and get tax-exempt bonds. But a really good question to ask today is, how do we determine the right time to borrow and the right amounts to borrow, especially when we have really a lot of changes going on in the capital markets I think everybody's well aware that there have been a lot of interest rate changes recently, especially in short-term interest rates, but also in longer-term interest rates as well. And one thing that's key is that adoption of this resolution actually positions the district in a great manner to be ready to enter the bond markets as soon as we believe it's the right time to do so. So it's a proactive step to make us ready to take those actions should it be the right timing to do so. Interest rates and market expectations are consistently monitored by both district staff, including a cross-functional team here at the district that works on our asset liability matching strategies called our ALCO committee. We look at those as well as our external financing teams that we work with to help keep us informed of what's going on in the market and what current options are. And in addition, our ALCO committee really focuses on managing to the lowest net interest expense for the district and minimizing the volatility around interest rates that the district is exposed to. And one of the ways we do that is we don't just look at our debt portfolio side, how interest rates affect the cost of borrowing. We also look at what are the opportunities for the district to invest our funds. So the net interest expense is the combination of what is it costing us to borrow funds and what are we earning on the funds that we already have on hand. So we're looking really to minimize the combination of those two. In addition, another critical factor for determining when is the right time to borrow is really looking at when do we need funds and using our financial forecasting tools to determine what is the right amount at the right time. And as we get nearer and nearer to the times we're forecasting needing to borrow, a lot of times those forecasts tend to change and shift. We are able to narrow down what our needs really are, and often that means we're able to borrow less than we maybe originally thought. And one of the reasons that that's really important is because another component of, unfortunately, tax-exempt authority is the IRS does have restrictions that we can only borrow so far in advance of when we think we're going to need funds. So one consideration is the IRS does not want to have too many tax-exempt bonds outstanding in the market at one time, because that potentially would allow taxpayers to purchase more tax-exempt bonds than are really necessary to fund capital and gives them a tax break where they don't have to pay income tax on those earnings. The IRS wants to ensure that most borrowers are borrowing just in time for their needs, with a little bit of room. So we have to reasonably have an expectation that we're going to expend the funds fairly quickly, or we can't issue tax-exempt bonds. So there's another component that we always have to be aware of, is trying to get that timing rate of issuing in advance of when we need to borrow, but not too far in advance to make sure that we don't jeopardize our access to those tax-exempt borrowing options.
What does fairly quickly mean?
So, well, and I guess fairly quickly, too, for the bond markets is kind of, it takes us a while to issue bonds sometimes. So we do have a window of time where typically we have to have a reasonable expectation that we're going to expend all of the bond proceeds within about a 3-year window. Okay. So we certainly wouldn't want to estimate, let's go borrow for everything we think we're going to need for the next 10 years or everything we think we're going to need for the next 5 years. One reason would be is we don't want to incur interest expense on money that we're not going to need to use till much later. Right. But another reason is those IRS restrictions is we have to have that reasonable belief that we're going to be able to expend those, what I would say, fairly quickly, capital projects over the next 2 to 3 year window. The good thing is that as we get closer in time to our forecasting, we always get better and better. We know with a lot of certainty what projects we're working on today and probably what we're going to be working on in a week or a month or a year. We have a lot less certainty the farther out we go. We may have some good ideas of the types of projects that we want to do or the types of projects we're planning, but it might not be quite as pinpointed. So this also gives us better information to pinpoint what is really that right amount to borrow. Our current financial forecasts indicate that we likely would not need to borrow the full $100 million that is being authorized in this resolution. The amount we're anticipating borrowing in future years is probably likely to be later and a smaller amount than that $100 million. But again, this is to preserve maximum flexibility. Should we need that access and should it be the lowest cost option for us, we want to be able to utilize that. So we want to be positioned well and preserve all that flexibility that we can. The other couple of items I just wanted to mention, too, is that bond financing is not the only option for the district. The district is in an excellent credit quality position. Dedication by management and the board of ensuring that our assets are managed well, they're in good operational condition, valuable resources for our community, and our financial condition has also been a focus to ensure that we are positioned well with our strong financials for generations to come. That also gives the district access to many opportunities for financial resources. Bank lines of credit, direct bank loans, short-term borrowing options to bridge market timing. So, for example, if interest rates are higher than we would like them to be, we don't have to issue 30-year bonds. There are lots of different tools the district has access to, which again adds a layer of financial flexibility that only very stable and very well-rated entities have access to. So all of those efforts have provided us the flexibility to really choose our timing and not have to be reactive to conditions. So I wanted to open it up commissioners, if you have any questions that I can answer regarding this resolution.
Commissioners, any questions or comments for Heather? Okay. Well, I think it's important to also state that, you know, as Heather shared, that we want to make sure that what we're doing is good for generations to come. This is really an important discussion as we look at the efforts that we've been managing debt, paying debt off, looking at when it's time to offer those again, those bonds again, and the timing, and just I really appreciate the foresight and effort that you guys are putting into this and keeping us informed. So, again, last chance for questions or comments, commissioners. All right. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
You can hold tight. I think we're going to vote on the resolutions before we move to the motion.
All right.
So we've got one resolution we'll have to hold off on.
Yep.
Right.
So what we're going to do at this time is to, I will be looking at the resolutions. Hang on here with me. This would be 13, 15, 16, 18, and 19. Do I have a motion for those resolutions? We'll come back to 14. With Rob later on.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolutions 13, 15, 16, 18, and 19 as presented.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion as mentioned, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Resolutions pass. And now we will go to the motion of item number 20. Do I have a motion for the proposed motion?
Heather, you want to introduce this? You mentioned this at the last board meeting. But
yes, I did. Request for a proposed motion from the board today, and the reason behind this motion is that the board planned in advance back in 2017 and 2018 that there were projects coming up for the district in many years into the future that would be long-term projects to work on our overall facilities plan, our long-term facilities plan. And one of the items that was done at that time was to selectively set aside funds in a board-designated account to create a savings account of sorts to be used in the future when those projects actually came to fruition and were underway. Currently, the board has actually been paying for those projects out of tax-exempt bond proceeds. Those were bond proceeds we issued in 2020 and that we did spend down over a couple-year period, and we have now fully expended those bond proceeds on the service center project in a portion of those bond proceeds on the service center portion project, as it was a qualified project for tax-exempt bond funding. We now are at the point where it is time to start utilizing that board-designated savings account, and so we are requesting a motion for staff to begin applying those funds towards the service center project.
Okay. Commissioners, any questions or comments for Heather on our savings account that we've set aside? Do I have a motion? I don't see any questions.
Mr. President, I would move to direct staff to apply amounts deposited in the board designated headquarters service center strategic facilities fund to project costs.
Second that.
Any discussion? Any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Okay. Manager item?
I do have a manager item, and I think we could get it done in the time frame we have.
Okay.
So that'd be okay.
Let's do it.
With us is Brett Bickford. You might recall we've been seeing a number of challenges with concrete at a project that's almost 100 years old, and Brett's going to share with us the latest challenge we have facing us.
Brett Bickford, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. And I've got a picture here, an aerial photo of Rock Island Dam. And we've got the drop gate structure there pointed with the arrow. The drop gate structure supplies attraction water to the fishway that you can kind of see there just above that yellow box. And that supplements the water going down the fishway to help attract adults to find it and be able to pass it. Since the hydro projects were built, all of them, Chelan, Rocky Reach, and Rock Island, were constantly monitoring movement and the safe condition and operation of the powerhouses. And for decades, we have seen very slow concrete growth at Rock Island. And that concrete growth is putting stress in certain parts of the structure. And that stress tends to radiate out from the powerhouse on each one of these corners. And a couple of years ago, we saw some cracks resulting here around Pier 1. And we did studies of those, and we remediated those cracks just last year. As part of that, we've been doing increased structural assessments of this concrete growth. And so we did some structural analysis to identify where next we might see the highest stresses. And that was identified here on the corner where this drop gate structure is located. And we'd seen some cracking going on inside that drop gate structure over the decades, and we've done some remedial work probably 15 or 18 years ago. We employed the district divers to do some inspections that we haven't done underwater, kind of in the vicinity of this arrow. And through that, we identified some cracks that were kind of predicted by the model through the stress that's resulting on the causeway that's going leading out onto the dam, into the structure itself. So it's putting stress. And these cracks are kind of indicative of what would happen from that stress. And so We've done some additional analysis, and we've consulted with our board of consultants that helps us monitor our dam safety. And we think that in the near future, we'd like to start remediating these cracks so that they don't get larger. And as these cracks get larger, they allow more water, more oxygenated water, into the structure that causes rebar degradation and things like that. So we're beginning our analysis now on what's the most cost-effective approach to start remediating this cracking. And so in the 2023 budget, we'll have O&M money. We propose to start doing repairs in 2023 and 2024. And these repairs might be fairly extensive, similar to the Pier 1 crack repair. We needed to relieve some of this stress, and so we'll be needing to do some concrete cutting on some of these joints to help relieve that stress. And again, like Pier 1, we have a number of utilities in the deck that we'll need to relocate to help make those relief joints in the structure. We're looking at whether this is still the best way to pass water to the adult fishway. It could be that we make recommendations to maybe modify that while we're doing that as well for more of a much longer term fix, so every 20 years or so we're not having to make remedial repairs to the drop gate structure itself.
Okay.
Any questions?
And you'll be back with us, keeping us posted on the progress.
Yes. Yeah, as particularly as we progress with any contracts that we might have to do any repairs. So we would be coming with a resolution to bid for the work and award and things like that.
So recognizing that our meetings are all recorded and you mentioned concrete growth, that's not a common layman term. And we've had the conversation before, and it was an aha moment to recognize that concrete over time does grow.
Yeah, and there's a number of structures in the Pacific Northwest, even the Midwest, that depending on the type of aggregate and cement and things that were used, they're seeing some places it's much larger growth than Rock Island. But yeah, it's modern day materials and science and knowledge know how to make the combination of materials and concrete that doesn't have that. But back when this project was constructed, they weren't so familiar with how those things could react chemically.
You just answered another question by saying that. I had a presentation once by you, I'm sure you remember Kim DeRobertis.
Yes.
About the history of dams. And he started with 2,000-year-old Roman dams that were made out of rocks that are still standing and still fulfilling their function. So dams can last a long time.
Yep.
I think I would just add that I really appreciate the team that does all the monitoring and analysis on our dams to have identified this early on as a area that we'd be concerned about. And actually, it was part of the semi-quantitative risk analysis process that we've been going through that identified this as a risk under static normal loading conditions. And so the thing that gives me comfort is they're identifying these things early and recognizing, just even without looking at them, you know, it drove them to go look because they were concerned about it and found this in the shape it's in. So it gives me comfort that they're proactively looking at these things.
Very good. All right. At this time, we will recess for a lunch break. We do have some visitors here, candidates, PUD commissioner candidates, and we just want to invite you. You're welcome to come downstairs and participate. Take advantage of the restaurant that we have downstairs, the cafe, and make that available to you, or you can go out eat lunch on your own. So just wanted to make that invitation. So at this time, we'll recess for lunch. We will be back at 1 p.m. Good afternoon, and welcome to the June 20th, 2022 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting.
Good.
Excuse me. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence any electronic devices that you have with you today. And if you're online, please mute your screens. We welcome the public's input at our meetings and remind you that these meetings are recorded you wish to address any item on the agenda, please raise your hand either physically or electronically that you wish to speak. When recognized, please state your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. And at this time, we are on item number 14 of our agenda. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. Everybody else, good to see folks in person. We are back today for approval of the large load interconnection agreement with Microsoft. We described it in a little bit of detail, the modifications from the template agreement that had been previously adopted by the board. And so back today for final approval. Just a high-level refresher, the process that was adopted for transmission and interconnection generally has kind of three phases. There's interconnection, which is hooking up to our system for any generator or significantly large load. There's the transmission itself, getting service across the wires. And there's for loads, power service as a third component. So this is just the first piece, just the agreement establishing rights, obligations for connecting the proposed data center to our transmission system. So with that, we did describe that the major deviation from our template agreement is that we have a different funding approach. We think this is beneficial for us. Microsoft proposed it because they found it beneficial for them, that instead of having a monthly invoice and a monthly payment with security posted in case there are mispayments, that we will have an upfront payment so that we'll have cash on hand to begin work. There will be a second payment when we have reached a sufficiently drawn down point, but not fully exhausting the first payment, and that will allow us to finish the work. This will obviate the need for a letter of credit or similar security because we'll be holding the funds. And we have a not to exceed amount that is in the contract, and this is basically to give certainty for their funding approval process, that they know how much to go and ask for, that we've built in contingency, we've built in things like taxes and related costs, but it is gives us a point to say, you know, this is how much they need to request. We also have check-ins along the way, again, that allow us to make sure we are not spending ahead of schedule. If we are, the parties can meet and confer, gives Microsoft time to request additional funding. So the idea is not that this is a hard cap that would then shift obligations and shift risk between the parties, but really is the target with the opportunity to revisit the amount and of course, stop work if we aren't able to reach agreement so that we can talk through and make sure we're at the right place. So with those provisions in place, we think that these deviations are good for the project. They continue to protect the district. We still have the same cost responsibility that was in the template that the board had previously approved. And along with that, we in this resolution have asked to revise the capital budget, since we will be receiving funds and adding this to these project costs to the budget. There is an item in the resolution for an increase to the capital budget in the not to exceed amount of $86.5 million. And we also note that in year 2022, it's around $8 million that is planned to be spent. We're going to begin procurement once the funds are received, and we've got the contract underway to make sure we can lock in the prices and not have project schedule risk. But even though we'll be entering those contracts, those funds won't be expended until later on. So only about $8 million in the $8.5 million in this year, with the remainder in 23 to 25. We'll pause there for some questions.
23 to 25. Sorry, I didn't catch that last.
Sorry, the remainder of the $86.5 million will be expended in years 2023 okay. through 2025. Sorry.
All right. Commissioners, any questions for Rob?
If I could, Commissioner, not hearing any questions, I did just want to take a moment. I believe we have our colleague, Emily Watt from Microsoft, on today. and just wanted to take an opportunity to
really
talk well about their team. Emily has been the primary contact for us, along with Sue Chung in legal. And I just have to say that in my 10 years of electric utility experience, this has been really one of the smoothest transactions I've been a part of. Really, you know, thoughtful deliberation, good conversation and communication, really both sides focused on how do we get the project to a place, the contract to a place that works for both parties without really trying to, you know, score a win in a roundabout way. And so when I was first asked if we could make this timeline, I said, sure, if everything lines up and things go perfectly. And I don't know if things went perfectly, but they went very well, and that was due in large part to the way the teams interacted.
Great. And they're online, did they? Great. Would you like to say anything?
Yes, if I'm able to, I definitely want to echo Rob's comments. And Sean, Steve, Chad have been absolutely wonderful to work with. We are really excited to be starting this project. And it is a long-term investment in the community. And just to kind of reiterate, our key focus is to not shift costs to other Chelan customers. We believe that your customers are Microsoft customers as well, and we certainly don't want them to not buy Windows products or Surface products because they're upset with us. That would be really bad for us. So we are excited to be in the community, to continue growing in Central Washington, which is our home state, and looking forward to lots and lots of continuously smooth partnership, hopefully. I echo that they were not contentious phone calls at all. It's really easy when both sides are looking to keep things fair and not look to score at the cost of anybody else. So I think we are excited to be moving forward and happy to answer any questions that you have, commissioners. And I look forward to seeing a lot more of you all. And I apologize. I should have introduced myself at the beginning as requested. My name is Emily Watt. I am the Director of Energy Markets for Microsoft. So I focus on all of our utility interactions for the Western United States.
Very good. Thank you, Emily. It's great having you with us today. Commissioners, any questions for Emily? Dennis.
Just a comment. Rob and Emily, thank you for providing, you know, the dialogue that you just did. Rob, I was going to ask, when you finished, when there was an appropriate moment, you know, just tell me in terms of the tenor, you know, how did the negotiations go? What do you feel transpired, you know, with this developing partnership? And before I had a chance to ask it, you guys responded. And you know, I remember the other negotiations, you know, in the recent past regarding the Redmond campus. Those were very amiable negotiations, and I had hoped that this had gone as well. This is important to us. We appreciate it, and there are going to be long-term benefits for the people of Chelan County, as well as for Microsoft, and a good partnership is always a good thing to have, and if it starts well, it usually ends well. So thanks to the two of you for leading the efforts, and much appreciation.
Thank you.
Great. Anyone else? I would suggest we go ahead and move into authorizing the resolution. Would anyone like to make that motion?
I would move that we approve resolution number 14.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Motion has been made and seconded. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. I heard Dennis.
I saw Gary.
Gary
didn't come through, but I saw
him. He's shaking his head. Okay.
Sorry, thank you. Yes, I will say that again. Aye.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
All right, motion passes. So thank you, Emily. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Okay, at this time we have no further manager items. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Commission items. Do we have anything from our commissioners today?
Commissioner items?
Mm-hmm.
Gary, do you want to go first? You want me to go first?
Well, can't hear
you're
you.
You're muted. Gary. You're muted, Gary.
Thank you. I was going to let you go first, Randy, and I'll pick up the crumbs behind.
Well, I was hoping for the easy part, you know, because you'd cover it all. And that Commissioner Arsenault and I just last week had the privilege of attending the American Public Power Association conference, and once again it was a marvelous conference. The setting was was sort of a challenge to. You know, if you haven't been there before, and Dennis, I know you have, the Opryland in Nashville, Tennessee, you can get lost in that facility and not even know how to get out. It's big. But the keynote speakers were, you know, again, top-notch, and I've shared with Kirk Hudson that even the engineers were a Twitter at the speaker on supply line disruptions, which you know, it's very timely. I would say not near as inspiring as The Economist, but very, very beneficial in talking about how we overcome the hump of not having enough transformers, wire, things that are in short supply with the supply chain issues. But I will say the enduring moment for me was when The Economist, and I can't remember her name off the top of my head, and I'm going to let Gary pick up a lot more than crumbs, tried to describe for us in lay terms the difference between purchasing of hard goods and services. And the way she put it to us was forever seared into my brain. She said, let me share with you. She said, I'm telling my husband that he cannot go down and buy that boat during this recession, but I'm still going to get my nails done. So that's, she did a lot better job than I did on it, but hers was the services. Her husband was buying hard goods. And she talked about, you know, the COVID recession caused people to quit buying hard goods or services. And when they came out of the COVID, they rushed back to the services, and you know, I mean, it was there was some good stuff, really was. So anyway, Gary, I'll let you take it from there. I mangled it completely.
No, you did a great job, Randy, and I have to agree that the speaker on the supply chain issues across America was actually a well-known expert worldwide. Teaches at Harvard, is a Harvard professor, and was able to share and bring clarity to a really complex topic. At the end, the conclusion, the short version is, he said, don't worry about it because supply chain will begin to catch up with itself. And in the next 18 months or so, we should start seeing a larger availability of those kinds of goods, hard goods, that we're struggling to get our hands on, like transformers, cable, wire, now. So that part was encouraging. The Economist was extremely fascinating with her vision on both the past history of previous recessions. She brought us forward to current day, and then even gave us a glimpse of what she thought the future of the economy might be as we move into the future. And it was certainly worth the price of admission. Let me tell you that is a conversation that I'll be sharing with each of you offline collectively as I have my notes in front of me and can talk in greater depth. But fascinating snapshot into the into where we may be heading going forward. And I also, Randy, like the point on the she was quite clear, and I'm going to get my nails done, but you know, my husband can't get a boat. And it all has to do with the timing and acquisition of either a service product or a hard good product. And you were right on, very accurate, Randy, and I did the same thing. She initially asked for a show of hands, how many people went out and replaced an appliance that was not broken during COVID. The recession, during COVID? And a lot of people raised their hand. And it was because we were all nesting, right? We were all at home. We were taking money that we might have spent at a restaurant or going on a vacation, a soft service good product, and applying that to a hard good product. Now, as COVID is winding down and becoming the environment's becoming more relaxed, individuals are going back the other way. And they're moving back into now going into service. And the issue here, of course, as we're all aware, is labor. I'm gonna make this short, but the one conundrum that I've been trying to struggle with figuring out what happened to all the service workers, where'd they go? And she made it really quite clear. She said, for example, her son graduated from college in 2010. At that time, we were in a recession. He couldn't get a job with his credentials from college, so he took a job in the service industry to tide him over. Now, and then the service industry had, of course, this gigantic withdrawal of workers. And now his son has moved into a job or a career that is more aligned with his college and his training and his education. So he's not going back to the service industry. And she said that really, is, in a nutshell, is they're not coming back. And so we're going to be dealing with this shortage of service workers for a very long time. Made it very clear. In something that I was scratching my head over for a long time. So anyway, that's not the condensed version. I apologize, but it was a really good conference and one that I'm certainly glad I went to.
Great. Thanks, Case. All right. Do we have any other commissioner reports? And I don't think we have Lisa here for travel. I don't think we have anything down for Commissioner items on that. Follow up on delegation of action items from previous board meetings.
We've got three items. One of them has been resolved. The one that was resolved was Heather was going to provide cost information for the Rocky Reach and Rock Island facilities projects, which she sent an email on June 7th that had that information. We've still got two items outstanding. One of them is the request for Alex Dunn from Strategies 360 to look at the customer satisfaction levels to see if we could filter out the data from renters whose average bills were above $75 to see what the satisfaction levels were from that group, and also provide information on the percentages of cell phone versus landline responses. I do have an email with that information. I want to see if we can combine the two together in response, so still working on that. And then Rebecca is going to work with Commissioner McKenna to schedule the Washington PUD Association visit with commissioners, which is in progress too. Great. And if I can jump to the next item.
Yes.
Which is delegated action items today. We had the one request for the number of customers on the Dryden wastewater system. I did get an email over the lunch hour. It was close to 50. In fact, I think it's the equivalent of 50 residential units, but the specific breakdown is 36 residential customers, 8 commercial, and 1 industrial customer.
Great. All right. This time, I will open it up. Do we have any additional public comment? Rebecca, I'm not seeing anybody online that's asking to address the board. Commissioners, okay. Do we have any other matters of general businesses may necessarily come before the commission today? Is there anything else? We do not have an executive session today, so we are adjourned.